papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on the issues affecting the news media these days with some veteran journalists, and we welcome you to join along in our conversation. This conversation, by the way, being number 1900. This is the 1900th Media Project show. No, 1800th Media Project show.
Feels like 1900.
Isn't that something? I'm Rex Smith, former editor of the Times Union, now doing the Upstate American on Substack. And my colleagues here are Judy Patrick and David Lombardo. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
You know, you would think after 19 or 1800 episodes, we would have figured out these conflict of interest problems that journalists tend to have. But increasingly, with this new generation of journalists, they keep hitting these same problems and they don't seem to know how to deal with them.
All right. Journalistic conflicts of interest. That's going to be a meaty topic. David Lombardo, host of WCNY's Capital Press Room, which you can hear wherever you like to get your podcasts. What's on your mind today?
Well, in addition to my Thanksgiving hangover, I'm also really focused on an entertainment news reporter named Matt Bellany, recently profiled in the New York Times. He's kind of out on his own with his own newsletter, his own podcast, and he's become this institution unto himself. And I'm curious whether that is replicable anywhere else, whether that's New York State politics or maybe even local government.
Maybe it's replicable for David Lombardo even. Think of that.
I wish, but I don't know if I have that skill set and support team that he has.
That is actually a really interesting conversation in the context of what's happening in the journalism ecosystem. So we have a good program for you here, folks, that we will look forward to sharing. And I do think I'm with you, Judy, on this notion of conflicts of interest. And I think it goes to the sort of broader issue of the way that journalists do their work. You know, we have different kinds of sources. We have documents that are sources. We have data that is a source of information. We have humans. And different journalists have different skill sets at mining these different kinds of sources. But it's in dealing with human sources, I think, that we most often find difficulties because, well, we're only human and therefore we're prone to problems. But just to give a couple of historical examples to show, as you said, this is not a new thing. George Will, the famous conservative columnist, was criticized for coaching Ronald Reagan during the 1980 presidential campaign before the Reagan-Carter debates. More recently, New York Times columnist Ezra Klein is one of the nation's top 10 podcasts. He's been criticized for leading closed-door sessions for Democratic senators, offering on his podcast specific advice for Democratic strategy. And then there's the conflict of interest. It's clearly over the line that's really going to be fun to talk to, and that has to do with Olivia Nuzzi, who was a New York Magazine political correspondent, and during that time, she apparently developed a personal relationship with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when he was running for president, and she profiled him. She insists it was limited to sexting, I guess, but nevertheless, she had to quit her job and has recently come back as the West Coast editor for Vanity Fair.
In 1,800 episodes, how many times have you said sexting, Rex?
Probably not very much. Sexting, yes, it is a new concept, but it's clearly a problem for journalists, right? So this kind of stuff goes on regularly. That is, it's a broad range of issues where we run into problems of journalists supposed to be engaged in independent work. It's one of the fundamentals of journalism, be independent. And yet, where are we when we get to this situation?
And she wrote a book. And someone published it. This is so brazenly wrong. I used to tell reporters, sources aren't your friends. They are not being nice to you because they like you. They're being nice because they want to manipulate the rules. The same thing with reporters. I used to say you can't buy off a reporter, but you can buy them with a tip. And I just worry that you need to remain impartial. And this undermines our credibility so substantially. And these cases like the Olivia Nuzzi case get so much play. I mean, in the journalism circles, the people think of journalists as always doing this. I mean, I think of even people who write books do this to some extent. Truman Capote, when he did In Cold Blood, he really became connected with the murderers in this case. And you have to wonder how much that impacted how he wrote the book. In some ways, you really, in that case, you need to be involved in some respects. But when you're a reporter writing a story, you do not sleep with your source to get more information. You just don't, despite what they do in the movies.
So there are clearly hard lines in the sand when it comes to journalistic ethics and relationships. But you talk about the idea that these people are not your friends. But in reality, you might have a lot of shared overlapped feelings. You might have commonalities with the people you're covering, might have a shared background. And I think the answer to this is transparency. We talk about the importance of transparency as journalists. And so I think if you are going to have any sort of relationship, whether it's friendly, whether it is romantic, you need to be transparent about it, meaning you talk to your editor, you say, hey, so-and-so is a second cousin of mine, or so-and-so and I went out to drinks together, or years ago I worked for somebody who knew this person. And you as a team can make decisions about, well, you're not going to cover this person, or we're going to look at your piece with a second set of eyes, or we're going to fact check this in a different way. And I think the real problem is that people aren't necessarily transparent when they try to do some of this work. They're, you know, if you're hiding it, you're probably doing something wrong. And I think a lot of people are also without a net. You know, they didn't have a Judy Patrick as an editor. They didn't have a Rex Smith as an editor that they could turn to and say, hey, how do I navigate this situation? And a lot of people are just kind of on their own. Someone like Olivia Nuzzi, she should know better, though.
Isn't there sort of a built-in difficulty, though, especially in a situation where you're in a pretty tight environment? You know, you're covering the Capitol, David, and I did many years ago during the tenure of Cuomo the Elder. And I remember the fact that you're thrown in with people who share your interests. These mm-hmm. are people who work around the clock and track what's going on in politics and public affairs. And you have the same reading lists. You're really there day after day. And I know that I had friendships that probably would be considered inappropriate if readers knew about them, because I was single at the time. I double dated with this couple who were engaged in politics. I know Judy's looking at me across the microphone here. Is this a confession time? No, but you get to know these people and they do become your friends. It's difficult then to be a journalist and to be really aggressive in your coverage if that's where your friendships are.
Part of the problem is that the reporters work so long and so hard, and actually many of them don't have lives outside of what they do in terms of chasing the story. That's all they do. So they are within that world. And it is understandable, especially for them to find romance, for example, with another reporter from a competing institution. I can remember that happened quite a bit. And then, you know, the reporters would come to me and they would say, well, you know, we don't talk about news, you know, if they're working for a competing newspaper or a competing media outlet. So they had rules within that relationship and you just had to trust it. Nowadays, I think that we have taken traditional ethics rules have kind of gone by the wayside for some of these new age reporters, especially at an upper level. I'm always amazed by someone like Olivia Nuzzi. She should have known, you're right, Dave, she should have known the rules, and she clearly broke them. And now she's writing a book, and it doesn't seem like she's really apologizing for it.
No, I think she's capitalizing on it. I think she knew the rules and decided that it was okay to break them because she thought he was hot.
I also think that we need to think about relationships and biases in the fact that we are all humans with backgrounds. We all maybe went to school. And so if we're covering an education issue, maybe we're going to think about public schools versus private schools differently. And so we take into consideration that we have biases and we try to counteract those in our reporting. You try to get from both sides of an issue. So I think these relationships, which can take various forms, are kind of an extension of that. And it's those best reporters who are cognizant of that, who are always interrogating, why do I think this way? How should I think about this? How would someone else think about this issue? That helps you navigate these things. But it does come back to me, again, that idea of having a sounding board for any of this stuff, having someone to talk to is important.
Sometimes the personal relationships are beneficial to your reporting.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a young reporter covering the courts on Long Island, for example, I remember the first thing that I would do every morning at the courthouse was I would go up to the Felony Screening Bureau and look at the new cases that had come in from overnight. And you know, those lawyers in the assistant DAs in Suffolk County would allow me to just go through the files and look at the people who were about to be arraigned in court. Now, that was inappropriate, I guess, on their part, and inappropriate on my part in that I was probably keeping out of my reporting some stuff that I wasn't supposed to see, let's say. I don't know, but it was certainly letting a reporter review files pre-arraignment was a great advantage to me because I had developed a personal relationship, a friendly sort of relationship with these ADAs that I dealt with all the time.
That idea of getting a human interaction with someone and that they then see you as a human being and not necessarily that institution that you're working for is beneficial. I think about the politicians that I've encountered in pickup basketball games who then say, hey, Lombardo's okay. You can go do his show. He's a human being. He's not going to, you know, treat you unfairly. He might ask you hard questions, and he probably will, but he's still a human being that you've met with, and maybe he did a pick and roll with you at one point.
I think it's also an issue of trust when you do that. Like Rex with Adan on Long Island, they trusted that if you came across a Social Security number, for example, on a piece of paper, you weren't going to publish it. And having those kind of connection does establish a kind of trust for when you're working a source. Trust is really essential to getting the really important stories out there.
One of the difficulties, as you say, in not having a big newsroom anymore is that you can't pass a difficult story to a colleague. In law enforcement, for example, when we would have a tough story at Newsday where I was working that would embarrass cops, the cops reporter would pass the story to me as the courts reporter. Likewise, I would pass the hard story on the prosecutors until there came a time when we had to investigate the district attorney's daughter in an alleged drug ring. And that got spicy and ended up being the time that I took a leave from that beat to pursue that investigation. But you don't have that luxury if you're sort of a one-man band. Can we say that, Judy?
You're the woman. I think you're okay with it.
Okay, that's an anachronism. But it's fine. And that actually, you know, we might just slip for just a second into this talk about Matt Bellany.
Bellany. Puck News and the Ringers, the Town podcast. Yeah, he was profiled in the New York Times recently. He's an interesting guy, a former entertainment lawyer turned journalist, and he's now part of this startup called Puck News. And he has a newsletter that's really popular. He has a podcast that is very popular. I think he reports having about 100,000 listeners. He has about 30,000 paid subscribers to his newsletter, paying, I think, about $150 a year. You do some back-of-the-envelope math, we're talking more than $3 million a year in revenue. And I wonder how replicable something like that is. And I've been talking with some of my friends at the Capitol about whether there's anybody who has the gravitas to pull off something like that right now. Obviously, maybe not at the $3 million in revenue, but someone like Nick Reisman of Politico New York came to mind with his newsletter. And I thought about somebody years ago, like Fred Dicker, who had sort of an in-demand radio show and how that might be a podcast today. And it's just something that I think has benefits because you are that one person, you're interacting directly with the audience. But then there are cons, like the fact that you are, as Rex said, a one-man band. You don't necessarily have a team that you can rely on outside of maybe the traditional distribution people. You don't have other reporters and colleagues in a meaningful way. So I don't know. Do you guys find that appealing? Does it seem like it's the future of journalism? You know, the Substacks are obviously a popular way for people to do journalism without a lot of infrastructure. But I don't know. I can see it both ways.
It's hard, I think, to do great reporting as a single person. As one person doing deep reporting, you need to have libel insurance. It is good to have somebody to bounce things
adding
off
that
of
to my to-do list for the Capitol Press Room. Don't know if, I guess it would be slander if I'm doing it on the radio, though, right?
Yeah, it would be, yeah. Be careful what you say here. But I think it is increasingly popular because of the ubiquity of these platforms like Substack, Beehive, Patreon, and so on that enable you to basically be your own publisher. publisher, Heather Cox Richardson, the historian professor at Boston College, has
who two, we all know.
Indeed, 2.5 million subscribers on her Substack newsletter. And I know a lot of people who really have to read Heather Cox Richardson every morning, they say. I don't think everybody is saying, oh, I have to read Rex Smith's The Upstate American. But I don't know, maybe they do. Not very.
But maybe there is an audience size that makes sense for you. Maybe you don't need 2 million. Maybe you need 1,000. Maybe you need 2,000. I don't know.
You know, I think it is a chunk of the future. But in addition to gravitas, I think you need charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things you heard when Lombardo mentioned that he needed to get libel insurance. It's that kind of wit that I think keeps... I mean, it's true. There's a certain amount of entertainment value that you have to bring to the publication in order to retain readers or listeners or viewers. And that is something that traditional journalists tend to not do. They tend to be... I mean, Heather Cox Richardson is, an exception to the rule. Her content tends to be long, but people tend to wade through it. I mean...
It's because she has such a great background. It's because she's an historian. She can draw on these years of graduate study to produce content. I mean, isn't saying content is king. You need to have something that people are going to want to latch on to, I think, beyond just personality. Or maybe... Maybe not. I guess it's a question of whether you want to be an influencer or a journalist.
Well, there's also the issue of objectivity versus subjectivity, because I think some people come to these wanting to hear what a person in the know has to say about an issue, and whether that's New York politics, and maybe you'll weigh in on how the budget process might go, as opposed to saying, well, on the one hand, it could go this way. On the other hand, it could go that way. And I think that kind of can get you into trouble at the same time, too, because you're offering opinions. You become more of the modern day columnist than the reporter just presenting different opinions, but maybe that's what people want.
People do seem to want to have more insight. Let's say that, you know, we've had a lot of critiques over the last few years, and we've talked about it often in this show, the death of what Jay Rosen of New York University called the view from nowhere, journalism that has no established point of view, that is simply he said, she said, and we have moved away from that over the last, well, actually it's been a couple of decades, that we've been saying, no, journalism is to give you what is true. And that may mean that you have to be very clear about something that is not true. The difficulty is in the Trump era, the White House is, of course, just consistently lying. And to say that consistently puts you at odds with about 40% of the electorate. So it makes the marketing of your point of view a little bit more difficult, I guess.
You know, marketing is really an important part of this because, I mean, until you get an audience growing, you are a voice shouting into the darkness or into the wilderness. And I can imagine that that is increasingly difficult. And you need the energy and, again, the charisma, the personality to get out there and market yourself on multiple platforms in order for your presence to grow in a way. You need to be on social media all the time. I mean, this is a 24/7 job to be done successfully. You can't just write something and put it out there once a week.
It does take a ridiculous amount of work. Heather Cox Richardson is often writing at 2 a.m., you know, and then has to go teach a class in Boston the next day.
And I guess I am a little erroneously using the term one-man band because you need a certain amount
of
infrastructure.
One person, Dan. Let's fix that.
I'm just going to keep saying it over and over again. I can't stop it at this point. It's just going to keep flowing out of my mouth. And the issue, though, is that you have something like social media. And if you're not good at social media, you need the infrastructure to put that out, because if it's not done well, it's not going to resonate with people. If you have a newsletter that doesn't look good, if it's not designed well, it's not going to connect with people. I think you guys talked about the issue in Saratoga with this Dispatch and how they've launched and trying to reach people. I find their product to be hard to navigate. And so they might have great content, but if I can't make my way through it and I don't want to make my way through it, it doesn't matter.
That's right. You know, and we had many decades to refine what a print product ought to look like. It's pretty easy to say this is what looks good in a newspaper. And we are still, I think, working on digital presentation, what's going to really work. And it changes all the time. Who would have thought that it mattered, as the Mondani campaign showed, that it matters to have vertical video?
Mm-hmm.
Why would vertical video be what people want to see when historically we've wanted horizontal photographs? Who knows?
Exactly. And, you know, the reporters, journalists used to be the coolest kids in the room. You know, they were up on things. And you know,
those were not cool rooms.
Like at a dinner party, they knew things. They were interesting to talk to. You put them on social media, and the word cringe is so appropriate. So many of them are doing it incorrectly. And it just, you have to just close your eyes and skip past some of this stuff.
I want to know more about this critique. What is your issue with the way journalists use social media?
Journalists are much like politicians. They're trying too hard. Many of them are trying too hard.
Okay.
Especially in TikTok videos. They just can't shed the old way they used to tell the story. And then when they try to be hip, I don't even know if hip is a good word anymore. When they try to be hip, you see this, the attempt, and that even adds to the cringe.
Sounds like ageism from Judy Patrick. frankly, I won't stand for it.
For every 10 TikTok videos by a journalist, there's one that is, I think, worth watching or entertaining or valuable enough for me to repost.
But isn't it great that they're trying? I mean, we want journalists to be on these platforms.
Yeah,
how do you reach people
right.
otherwise?
But it comes back to the tools, because I will shoot videos in my studio for the Capitol Press Room for our other podcast, Dispatches from Planet Albany.
Which are pretty good.
But I'm not usually the one making them. I have a fresh out of college producer who cuts them together. You have to have that infrastructure. I can make a video. I can potentially turn a tenderloin into something that resembles filet mignon, but she will actually cook it appropriately and give you that nice medium rare filet.
So you need production values, but you also need
You need language skills. Look what he just did. I mean, actually, it takes.
I would argue about the tenderloin metaphor, though. I would say chuck steak, maybe.
No.
Chuck steak?
I don't know.
That's the Daily Gazette budget talking there.
This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you haven't heard us before, here we are, folks. That's David Lombardo of Capitol Press Room, Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, and I'm Rex Smith. We are talking about the new journalism ecosystem, really. And actually, I want to go back to this conflict of interest question, because it does go to how these individual players are cultivating sources and delivering content for people. You know, one of the great advantages of having more of this individualism in reporting is that it breaks the pack. We used to worry all the time when I was covering the state capitol that we were just part of the pack of three dozen journalists sitting there. I don't know, folks, if you don't know the state capitol, the governor's staff is on the second floor, the legislature and the reporters are on the third floor. And what's on the fourth floor? You know, most reporters had no idea about that. And one day when I first came to the state capitol, I started wandering the fourth floor and found, you know, that's where the Ways and Means staff of the assembly was. And amazingly enough, I developed some sources who knew about, I mean, they could explain stuff to me because I didn't even know the lingo. What's a chapter amendment? What's an Article 7 bill? I mean, these are ridiculous stuff that I had to learn. But I developed sources that nobody else had because I was wandering the fourth floor. And I think that one of whom, by the way, Dean Feulahan, who was then a young assembly staffer, is now the first deputy mayor of New York City.
Because everything is cyclical.
Yeah, but, you know, they all come back. Wonderful thing. Dean was very helpful. But I think that the individual players these days have the opportunity to break out from the pack and to set themselves apart and to say, this is my unique brand. I am this person. And people like that. People like to identify a brand that they like to associate with. It's like being an influencer. Really, but you're an influencer with journalism behind you, right?
You know, pity the poor person who's out there trying to decide what to subscribe to, what to listen to, when there are a million choices. That is one of the challenges. My friends turn to me and they say, well, what do you listen to? You know, I have so many things people are referring me to. I don't know what to do. There's not enough time in the day. And so if there was a way to put them all together in a way that would give people the opportunity to decide what they wanted to pick every day instead of them having to chase around individual newsletters. I mean, my email every morning is just overflowing with news updates.
Oh,
and so how do we help the people out there who we want to be our audience to find us and to find the thing that they're looking for?
Aren't we in a stage right now where we are looking for those aggregators? It used to be that people would say, well, I subscribe to the Daily Gazette, I subscribe to the Times Union, and they aggregate content for me, and I trust that brand. We are, I think, in a system now where we don't have so many aggregators who are able to do that. Will there be some things that will develop that will replace that, basically, or replicate that?
It was supposed to be your Twitter feed at one point. You were supposed to be able to follow people, and that was going to be where you could check in during the day and scroll, and now it's where you can go to get AI videos and, you know, ads for Cialis. So maybe that's just my feed. So that was maybe the king that was promised in Game of Thrones speak, but in reality, it never really materialized or stopped being that. So I do think it's tough to figure out which newsletter to subscribe to, which TV station to check for the nightly news for. It's difficult.
And in the context of the news that people need, what's especially missing in this whole discussion is the hyper-local news and the areas that are really underserved. We talk about rural communities that used to have weekly newspapers that paid attention to their town boards and so on. I think that there is perhaps some hope, but it still hinges upon a business framework that can support it, some hope for individual players and communities who will be like your local correspondent who will cover the town board in Averill Park or in Glenville and will then be available to you. But there needs to be some financial support for that that might be coming in the form of an advertising framework that will allocate individual ads to support
them.
Yeah,
can a community of 3,000 support a person covering the town day in and day out? Maybe the town doesn't need day in and day out coverage. Maybe you aggregate all the towns in a county, but local journalism has that downside to it. The communities being covered are often too small to financially sustain an operation of that kind of magnitude.
Absent philanthropy, I guess. I mean, if there is somebody who wants to say, yes, I'm going to support local journalism in Herkimer County, New York, let me have somebody who will do that. I don't know where you're going to find that, but that might be. And again, you need someone who can appeal to a broad enough audience to reach people. And maybe that's what David means about finding that magnetism, sort of somebody who can actually reach those people with stories they need to have.
Or you go hyper-targeted, though, because that is more appealing to advertisers. If you can say, here, I can deliver this sports-loving crowd. I can deliver the well-to-do in Saratoga Springs. I can deliver soccer fans, whatever it is. If you can say to them, I've got a direct line to these people, maybe you become more appealing to advertisers.
So many questions and too few answers. Folks, if you have a thought about this, by the way, we'd love to hear from you. Media@wamc.org is how you communicate with the Media Project. Media@wamc.org. And that is all we have time for in this week's exciting Media Project. You've been listening to David Lombardo from the Capitol Press Room. Get that wherever you like to download your podcasts. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette. I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate American. And we appreciate the producer of the Media Project, David Gustina. Thanks for joining us. We hope to see you again next week on The Media Project.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room on WCNY. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Wall Street never has complained. But publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.